This is the House Ladies Committee meeting in hearing room E on Friday, May 13, 8 a.m.
Order, please. One more time with feeling. We think the equipment's back on the line. We're going to hope so. As I announced a couple minutes ago, 2014 and 2933 are going to be carried over till next week at the request of the proponents who wanted some additional time to review with members the amendments. We don't have session this morning, unfortunately, till 11. I think we'll be running right to 11. We'll take a break somewhere halfway in between. As far as the order, I think we'll go ahead and start with 2592, then move to 2908, and then we'll get into the comp bills. We do have one matter. 2592 is on the table by rule. The chair would move that 2592 be removed from the table for purposes of additional public comments and work session this morning. Is there any objection? Not 2592 is off the table. Okay, why don't we go ahead and get into that? I think I'd ask representatives of the Employment Division perhaps to come forward. I had a chance to speak yesterday with Ms. Leonard, and we had carried this over to this date in order to allow an update, if you will, in terms of information as far as what money, just the status of the UI Trust Fund, where it's at, where the trends are going, and just with that kind of information, I think it's necessary before we take any further action on 2592.
Mr. Chairman, Libby Leonard, Deputy Administrator of the Employment Division. The quarterly collection for the first quarter of 1983 and up until May 12th, or as of May 12th, was $80 million. The trust fund balance on May 12th is $129,960,000, or rounded $130 million. Now, of the balance, well, I can go on and give you some projections of the trust fund balance for each quarter of this year and then generally in the next few years, if that's what you would like to hear.
Why don't we, if that won't take too long.
No, it shouldn't.
Okay, go ahead.
The balance today of $130 million will be reduced by payout of benefits up until June 30th of $60 million, which would leave $70 million on June 30th, but that will be increased by reimbursements we will get back from reimbursing employers and the federal government on federal claims of $14 million, so that we expect to have $84 million plus perhaps another million in collections by the end of June. We're looking then at our balance in the trust fund to be between $85 and $90 million the end of June of this year. We had told you in the last projection we had, which was made a month or so ago, that we thought it would be around 96. So it is slightly lower than our projection for June 30th. The projection we had when we had the 96 as June 30th, 96 million, we then were saying that September should be about 103 million and December about 105 million. We're not ready to change those, although since the 96 will be closer to somewhere between 85 and 90, rather than say 103, I might say 100. We're right around 100 million for the rest of this year. In 1984, we have the trust fund reaching a low again in April of under $100 million and then building back up so that at the end of 1984 be somewhere around $175 million. In 1985, we see it growing, and now all of these are using the assumption that first of all that the laws remain as much the same as they are today. Secondly, that our economic assumptions are correct, and of course those are based on cyclical ups and downs of the economy. But in 1985, if we get that far, with these assumptions, we assume that we'll have around $300 million at the end of that year. 1986, around $500 million at the end of that year.
I assume from that those projections reflect in 85 and 86 an improving economy. That almost has to go with that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, we do the projections based upon what we look at in the economy. We had projected that we would have a slightly and slowly improving economy in 1983, getting better in 84 and 85. I think they're looking at a cyclical downturn somewhere around 86 or 87, but that would not be of the kind of magnitude that we've experienced in the past 2 years. We did publish a forecast, and I believe members of the legislature all received copies, showing various patterns. There were four patterns available, and we're still using the same one that we figured would be the forecast.
So you're reflecting really a very flat period for the rest of this year, obviously, with those balances.
No, I don't think so. I think we're reflecting an upturn in the economy this year, and a lot of these projections were made last year, and so far it has turned out just about as we had reflected.
Great crystal ball.
Well, the last 2 years have kind of made us very edgy about saying anything, but I think that we're probably as good a forecaster on this as anybody else in this business.
Yeah, I want to point out to members, just to refresh your memory, we do have some fiscal estimates prepared by the Employment Division. I think probably the latest bunch of data we have is April 19, 1983. And we do have, earlier we discussed in the context of this bill, some amendments submitted by Anita Paulson from Warden Legal Services Corporation. And those amendments and support documents bear the dates April 11th and April 14th. Representative Leake, I guess you had earlier pursued the issue of the sign-off and weekly benefit reduction and the effect on the fund. Do you have any follow-up questions?
Mr. Chairman, I guess it's all pretty well laid out at this point. My desire was to look at those kinds of situations where employees had had lost their benefits because of voluntary quits or discharge for cause, and to look at the sanctions that were available due to the changes made in the last legislative session, and to see whether they seem to continue to be appropriate, and to see whether we, considering the continuing relatively flat state of the economy, the lack of opportunity for people to get jobs again, whether there's some way that we could mitigate the effects of the action taken by the last legislature, which resulted in a very substantial savings to the fund, but has caused a very substantial hardship to people. And so the Employment Division was kind enough, after we went through several workups, to end up with the April 19th figures. And what I've been looking at seriously is what we call 12 by 12, which would be basically a 12-week waiting period and a 12-week benefit reduction. The effect of that would be that former employees would be eligible for a maximum of 14 weeks worth of benefits without going back to work, because the law on the federal extended benefits requires requalification by working to be able to get beyond the 26-week period. So looking at that April 19th, the front sheet of the April 19th chart that the employment provision provided to us last time, in the second row of figures, the 12-week sign-off, the 12 times weekly benefit amount and reduction is the one that that I'm looking at would cost the fund over the two-year period some $20 million. And we've heard apparently that the fund is in as low as going to be around effectively about $84 million this year, and then we'll be rising above that. So I think that we're in a situation of being able to afford that and recognizing the continued state of the economy to be able to give these people some kind of minimal assistance. I don't think it seems to be too high of a cost. Council is working but has not yet prepared the amendments necessary to do that, but I would like to I'd like to move them conceptually because it's a relatively simple situation, and that would be that I would be moving a 12-week waiting period, a 12-week sign-off with a 12-week benefit reduction to be substituted for the current law and included in House Bill 2592.
Okay, Representative Leek, I'll place that as a motion, if you wish. Representative Leek moves that House Bill 2592 be amended conceptually, and apparently Chuck Wilson is already preparing these amendments, though they're not quite at this point, which deals with the issue of restoration of benefits after a voluntary quit, or under those circumstances which it's argued that the disqualification is for a voluntary quit. And in effect, your 12-week sign-off with a 12-week reduction in benefits. And that the fiscal side of that is reflected in the Employment Division statistics presented to us bearing the date April 19th, 1983.
Yes, right, that came down. That's correct. The total of $8,900,000 in 84 and $12,100,000, $186,000 in the fiscal year 85.
Okay. Motion's been placed. Let me ask if you folks have any additional specific comment. I think we had an opportunity to review these figures with you a little bit earlier, but let me ask if you want to comment further at this point.
What about extending? Yeah, the only, well, when we see the bill, then we will come up with an impact statement. The thing that we're discussing among ourselves is the $8.9 million in 84 and the $12.1 million in 85, we don't think includes the fact that we would trigger back into extended benefits. And we had a separate sheet on that of an increase of $16.6 million. But we will, when the words are developed, we will develop your impact statement.
Could you repeat that? I'm not sure that I heard you. Could you repeat that, please?
You're referring to the information on the second sheet that was provided.
You have a sheet dated April 19th, which Representative Leek has been using, that shows various configurations, and the 12 by 12 is in the lower left-hand corner. And this is regular benefits, the impact of regular benefits. So it would be $8.9 million in fiscal year 84 and $12.1 million in fiscal year 85. Then there's another sheet dated, I don't know if the committee has this.
Yes, but dated April 19th as well.
Well, I have one dated May 3rd. Now, is there in May, April 19th?
I know.
That shows the
April 19th.
This one. That has the increase in expenditure.
Yes,
okay, I'm sorry. I did not have that one in front of me. I had another one showing the extended benefits. Same figure, 16.6. So that will show up in our final impact statement when we get the actual words of the bill.
So we're.
That
would be $37,600,000 would be the increased cost then of putting this in place. Is that what I hear you saying to the fund?
Well, the April 19th sheet shows $39,887.
Oh, $39 million. Now that one I didn't. Okay.
Well, it shows net cost to the fund at the bottom, $28 million.
Right.
Right.
After you get the payback from the federal reimbursing
that. The net cost of the fund would be $28 million for this proposal then.
That's correct.
Okay.
Does that for the 2-year period?
That's the that should be the 83-85 biennium, and the other column the 85-87.
Now that represents as well the extended benefits portion represents then extended benefits for people other than the folks who have been disqualified, and represents then that you're estimating that we'll be bringing an additional $7 million worth of federal money into the state if we trigger onto extended benefits.
No. That would be correct.
Let's go back over that again. Is that, how do you add more people? I assume you're going to take the same people that are here and you're just adding, you're just trailing off with extended benefits for that group. Is that correct?
No.
Okay, what are you doing then?
If we have a law that allows people to sign off for 12 weeks, we then raise the number of claimants in the insured unemployment rate to a point where we will trigger on to extended benefits. We had not expected to have enough weeks claimed in the system to be on extended benefits in the 83-85 biennium. These 12-week sign-offs claimants who will be coming into our office would raise the number of weeks claimed to where we would have extended benefits for all claimants, not just these people. And by doing that, we then have a new payout of extended benefits, which shows up in that sheet.
So
that's a $16,600,000.
So what we're doing at that point then is we're really beginning to count the number of unemployed people more accurately. Is that correct? For the purposes of determining what the federal benefits are going to be.
You would be counting people who are not counted now.
Yeah. So you just open the door to triggering in that group that would otherwise not have been eligible.
Representative Johnson, we're on their employment division. What it amounts to is that our projections, if they're accurate, show we'll just be on the margin, just under the trigger level of 6% insured unemployment rate. We only have to go over that 1 week in order to trigger on. Once we trigger on, we have to be on for 13 weeks. So we're going to be very, very close anyway, but we're still projecting we would not be on. But they added weeks claimed when people were signing off the disqualification. We're projecting would be enough to bring us over that 6% level for one or more weeks, which would then trigger in at least a period of extended benefits lasting at least 13 weeks.
Okay, I think I understand. So the net impact on the fund then would be at the end of 84, you'd be down to 145, 150 million, and 85 another, it would be the 25 total, is that right? Is that a fair assumption, or is that incorrectly translated?
I'm shuffling so many papers.
What he's saying is, what would be the are you asking, Representative Johnson, what the trust fund balance would be?
What would the likely trust fund balances be at the end of 84 and 85, if that's possible? That may be asking too much.
Ballpark it if you have
to. Yeah, ballpark it's fine.
If I said 173, and then you take away, what, half of that? No, this is a biennium.
In fact, just...
No, I'm sorry. This 28 million is one... Yeah, it's a biennium, 83-85, okay. So then in 84, that would be... want some portion of the 28 million out of the projected trust fund balance.
I suppose it would be 160 to 150, 160 million.
It isn't the end of the year that I'm worried about. It's the it's April.
It's April.
It's where we drop down to 70 million, and we have already projected we're going to drop down to that or lower in 84 in April. This drain would drop us a little bit more, and I don't know how much more right at that point.
Not over certainly $15 million.
No,
probably not. So in other words, you might drop then as low as
$50 million,
probably.
I would agree that that would be a good estimate.
Which would be roughly equivalent to where, well, actually, we did not quite drop quite that low this year.
No, we dropped to
Mr. Chairman, I really don't think we ought to be proposing to amend the bill till we have some amendments in front of us that we can work with. I don't think it's useful or necessary because we can do it in the motion when the amendments are there. This is his proposal. We certainly can consider it until the amendments are there, and then we can act when they arrive.
Mr. Chairman, the conceptual amendments are very clear, very direct. All that we would have would be simple implementing language from legislative council. It's nothing exotic, nothing tricky. 12 weeks waiting period, 12 weeks weekly benefit reduction. It would retain the language. It's on page 2 of the bill in subsection 5. They only changed that to 12 weeks as opposed to 8 weeks. It's in there now, and would add another section referring to the 12-week disqualification period. As members of the committee should also understand that during this 12-week period, this 12-week waiting period, is not sitting at home. They would be, the claimants would be required to complete the work search and file with the Employment Division on a weekly basis, just as if they were drawing benefits.
Okay, I appreciate both those comments. We do have Representative Leek's motion before us. In response, perhaps, to the Vice Chair's concern and the follow-up comments from Representative Leek, I think we're kind of at the point in the session where if we had the luxury of delay, I'd be more than glad to do so. I think the clarity of the issue, however, is such that we can move conceptually, and if the language becomes a problem, if the Employment Division, if our counsel, if Dick Wilson, or if anyone reviewing the actual language of the amendments has a problem, we will certainly take a reconsideration motion. But I think we're kind of at the point where we just don't have the luxury of waiting. And believe me, the next few weeks, it's going to get even worse. So I think we're going to have to sort of forge on if there's a consensus or if there's a majority of the committee that wishes to proceed as Representative Leek has suggested. So, yes, we'll take questions and comments about the effect of the amendments, and then I'll recognize Representative Johnson. Representative DeBoer.
Yes, I would like to address this to the Employment Division. Now, I'm concerned about this in as much as looking at some of your projections. I guess your outlook's a lot more hopeful than mine is. If there's some of us that have the philosophy that the interest rates are going to go back up by October, November, and which means there will be another period of time when we will be regressing more, you know, with the timber and things, more shutdowns and things for a while. How long will that take, if that happens, how long will that take to catch up with in your particular system? Do you understand what I'm asking you?
In the lumber and wood products industry, part of the equation, of course, would be how many people would work long enough to qualify for a claim if they've currently exhausted all the benefits due to them. If this upturn is only temporary but does last for several months, of course there could be a requalification for benefits. And so that would depend somewhat on how many people would be drawing, which would be drawing down a trust fund. We have been looking at projecting, as Libby said, the four patterns, economic patterns, looking at those possibilities. We've felt that pattern B was the most apt to occur. We've been running sort of B minus for a while. We've been running a little bit worse than what we had projected. It looks like now we're just about on line on pattern B. If that were to drop back to, say, as far as pattern C or something, then we probably are looking at trouble. We're not projecting that to happen. But certainly the interest rate is the driving force behind a lot of what's happening right now.
Thank you.
I'd like to follow behind that. Yeah, with as we've all noted in just this last week, Treasury bills are starting to rise in interest rates, and it's, I think it's very reflective of what Representative DeBoer is saying. But would those people qualify if they actually work this particular segment? Would they qualify for benefits if they worked from what have been most cases, I would say, April through September, October? Is that enough?
Yes, in most cases it would be, because we're looking at 18 weeks of work. And
18 weeks of work.
Right.
And that, so that potential is really out there, that the fund balances could be, if we have a downturn rather than this slight tiering that you're upward that you're talking about, that we could run right out of funds. You're going to pick up the bulk of the lumber products people. What, 50,000, 70,000 people, which probably you're going to be paying benefits for about 30 of those over the winter if this scenario goes.
Well, of course, we have the snowballing effect where the, we have mills shut down and service industries, restaurants, everything else are affected, and the reverse occurs when they go to work. Mm-hmm. It is possible that that things beyond our control to anticipate will impact the economy. We're still, we still think pattern B is awfully close. It might be B minus, but we don't think it'll get as far as C, but we sure could be wrong.
Well, Mr. Chair, I really at this time do not believe we should change the system, because we had put the fund at risk and those many other hundreds of thousands of people who are out there at risk also. And I do believe that we should not change the system at this time. I just believe that that people are beginning to realize their responsibilities in the job place, and I believe that the law is plenty liberal as it relates to any unfairness as to options. We may have one or two we need to fix, but to change the structure to allow an expansion of benefits at this time, I do not support. We have to make sure that that fund maintains its solvent position.
Thank you. Representative Leek, briefly.
Briefly, yeah. First, in regard to the numbers that are here, I was told, I think in the first week or possibly the second week of the session, by a respected Republican member of this committee, how accurate the Employment Division always was in their projections and how much we could rely on what they were. And I found that to be true so far, and I assume that these are going to continue to go in that direction. I would like to ask, though, about we have the specter of there being less money in the fund than we would like to have there. Mr. Nairn, how many states now have negative fund balances?
I can give you an approximation. There are approximately 30 who are borrowing or are expected to borrow in the very near future.
Okay. And if a state borrows from the federal government for its fund, how long do you have to pay that back before you begin paying interest?
If it's repaid, and I'm trying to remember, Representative Leek, because I have not been following this that closely, because I hadn't, hopefully would not get in that situation. But as I recall, if you borrow after January 1st of a year, and if you repay that loan by, I believe it's September the 30th of the same year, then it's considered a cash flow problem and interest is not due. However, if you borrow before January, or you cannot repay the interest by, or repay the loan by that time, then you have an interest that is the prevailing rate of interest is being accrued to the federal, to the trust fund, if in the in the federal budget, with a cap of 10%. However, the interest is now accruing at less than 10%, so it looks like it would be actual interest.
So, in other words, were we to end up in a situation next April where your predictions are off by some, what are we talking about, $50 million, and you had to borrow some small amount of money until September, there would not be any interest implication for the state whatsoever.
That's my understanding. I do not want to go on the record without bringing the information and be precise, but that's my understanding of how it would happen.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johnson.
Is it correct that the 1981 law that changed the benefit structure, the last phase of that?
Ross Morgan, Chairman of the Employment Appeals Board. I would really like to point out to the members of the committee that in 1980, and I think you folks have these figures we gave you the first day, we had 1,452 cases that year. 1981, we had 1,629. And in 1982, we had 2,530. And the board gets paid according to how many transcripts there are to read, and that's directly resulting in more money for the board. And when in 1980 the board would not have made anywhere near the amount of money that they did in 1982, and it goes up and down, and we're hopeful that this depression will get over someday, and that's why it's on a sliding scale, because it would be reduced drastically if we would go back to the level of unemployment that we had in 1980. And so these are the figures. The only increases in this budget of any consequence at all is the fact that the agency itself was doing the transcripts up until the middle of last year. And then the board took over doing the transcripts and contracted them. And the cost that you see, the increase in the budget, is directly attributable to the fact that we now have a function we didn't have before, which is producing transcripts. And so that's what the increase is all about. And the rest of it is just pure caseload. And the number of staff that we have is exactly the same now as it was when the load was half as big. And so our people are working their tail ends off to keep up with this thing, and working a lot of time they don't get paid for, because the number of positions is exactly the same as when the load was half as big as it is now. On a basis of how we operate and the fact whether or not we are timely with getting our transcripts out, the federal government rates us at the top of the list. According to their budget load, the cost information that goes through into the system shows that we're earning just about twice the amount of positions that we're actually using. In other words, according to the federal standards. And we in no way take a back seat to any other agency in the country on the basis of the timeliness and the fact that we're doing the job and doing it properly.
Okay, I'm going to recognize Representative Leek in just a moment, but how long has the Employment Appeals Board been around?
58 or 59, somewhere around in there. Okay.
I would guess that, and I don't want to try to speak for others, that when it started out, it was more or less, I mean, it's different from some of our other boards. It wasn't conceived as full-time employment. I mean,
that's right.
It started out part-time. I don't know what the obviously, there's been a substantial increase in the workload.
4 years ago, when I went on the board, we had just about half. I was working about 2 days a week, and it was just fine. And my basic business over the years, other than politics and and the bureaucracy has been the life insurance business. I had to drop it when we got about 18 months ago, and I'm not even licensed anymore.
I think that change in circumstances probably is the cause in part for people sort of reevaluating
Right.
Is this a volunteer part, well, not volunteer, but a part-time, or is it full-time? And I don't think it's necessarily a criticism of any individual member or even necessarily of the activities. It's just that apparently circumstances are such that, and the responsibilities, the time factors are such.
The problem with trying to make a determination in a worst recession year we've had since the 30s is the fact that we are hopeful, and I'm sure that this panel is hopeful that we are going to go back to something more normal in the way of unemployment. If that should happen, it will then become a part-time board again.
Okay, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of comments. One, the fact that the staff has remained the same throughout with this increase in workload, you know, may indeed indicate that they're now working their tails off, or it may indicate to me that they're now just working, and before they were doing very little. And I'm not making that accusation, but that's, you know, one of the questions that gave rise to one of the points that gave rise to my amendments, which is that we want to, you know, want to look at it a little bit more carefully. Second, in regard to the question of the review by the Ways and Means Committee, the review by Ways and Means of those activities that are financed entirely out of federal funds is entirely different from the kind of review of those activities that are financed out of the general fund entirely or partially out of the general fund. And so the purposes of the amendments are to create that kind of intensive review without recognizing the questions that have been raised, without at this point making any accusations, but just providing a forum for that to occur in the future.
Okay, any further comments at this point from you folks at the witness stand? Do you?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Tom O'Connell, Executive Secretary, Employment Appeals Board. This is the third or fourth day we've met concerning this bill and its amendments. We have not heard any concern from labor, management, the governor's office, the employment division, or legal aid who represents many of these claimants regarding the statutory makeup of the board. I don't ask for an answer, but I would like the question placed in the record: where is the overriding need to sunset the board and place the function under the Employment Relations Board? Mr. Chairman, I do have a document I would like to enter into the record.
Certainly.
This document is a draft of a proposed administrative rule which, should this bill pass as amended, and the amendments on page 4 of the engrossment, defining the term promptly as used in ORS 657.275, and the effect of the proposed rule would be that 80% of all cases be decided within 45 days from the time the application for review is filed, and 95% within 60 days to set some criteria and define that term. If I may, I would like to introduce that proposed rule into the record. Thank you.
Okay, we'll receive it. I don't know if you have time for everyone, but certainly receive it and make it part of the record. It's my understanding that if we were to adopt the language in your set of amendments, that that rule would then be adopted by the board in order to, if you will, state in greater detail just what it is that you intend the statutory amendment to affect.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lee, just briefly, although Mr. O'Connell didn't require a response, since I believe it's appropriate that every aspect of state government from time to time should be reviewed, thoroughly reviewed, as to its efficiency and propriety and organization, and particularly when questions have been raised about it, but generally just as a matter of policy. The board has been in its current form since the late 50s, as I understand it, and I just think it's time that that we took a look without making accusations and without digging up anything that might be out there, and see if it can indeed continue to justify its existence.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman,
yes,
I have one technical point. In Representative Leake's proposed amendments, the very last section, section 12, I think what is intended is that this amendment will not take effect until September 85. What I'm worried about, and council would have to take a look at it, is that the way it's written, if it's amended into the bill along with the engrossed amendments that you also had before you, that it might wipe out the whole bill. It just does not appear to me to do the job in the way it's intended.
I see. That's a good point, Ms. Leonard. Thank you for bringing that up.
This would fall into the category of legislative council that it's a bitsy, little small type that's not actually made part of the statute, I think, if the intent is effectively realized, if the amendment were to be adopted. And for better or for worse, we have that kind of, those kinds of things happen in our statute all the time. They're not big letter print, but it's a little small type for those kind of conditions on or before, in the event that, et cetera. Let me throw it open. I think Representative Johnson suggested, and it would probably be appropriate briefly, if there are any members of the public who would like to respond to, from business, labor, et cetera, to the concept at least proposed by Representative Lee and Representative Hamlin. Okay, if there is no one who wants to comment on that.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move with the change that's going to have to be made, as Senator suggested, so that the section that this is redrafted by council, so that it's clear that September 185 effective date only takes effect in regard to these amendments. I would move the LC amendments HB 2908-1 dated 5/12/83.
Okay, Representative Lee moves
amendments to House Bill 2908 prepared by Legislative Council bearing the date May 12, 1983 as further amended in the final section to accomplish the purpose that was stated. I want to refamiliarize members of the committee with the rules that it takes majority of the committee to amend any motion. That means five people. Is there any further discussion or comment on Representative Leake's motion?
Call for the question.
Okay, Representative Johnson calls for the question. I don't think there's any objection to that. Clerk will call the roll on Representative Leake's motion.
DeBoer?
Can you come back to me?
Okay.
DeBoer?
No.
Gold?
No.
Hanlon?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Leake?
Aye.
Shiprack?
Aye.
DeBoer?
No.
Springer?
Aye. Motion fails.
Mr. Chairman, I move the engrossed amendments to House Bill 2908 dated 5/4/83 with the inclusion of the change that Mr. O'Connell pointed out.
That's not actually an amendment. I think it's, if you will, it's a rule that they propose to adopt.
Okay.
Before we, I'll go ahead and place your motion, Representative Luke. Representative Luke moves the amendments proposed bearing the date May 4th, 1983, which are incorporated in a revised draft engrossment of 2908, And it's, I think it's understood as part of the intent and the legislative history and record that the administrative rule to define promptly is part of, if not the motion, certainly our understanding of the practice that will be followed by the board. Yeah, I have, I guess, a question that I didn't have a chance to raise earlier that I'd like to raise to the proponents. Perhaps Mr. Morgan, if you can come forward. This is on the final page of the amendments or the engrossment, and that's in what is Section 9, Subsection 6. Again, it's at the top of page 9. It's the chairman on behalf of the Employment Appeals Board may, subject to budgetary limitations, employ a review officer. We delete some language and insert and staff necessary to discharge its duties. Then there's further deletion or bracketed material that takes out the sentence, all such employees shall be in the classified service and any promotion or increase in compensation is subject to the approval of the personnel division of the executive department. It would appear to me that some of that language is surplusage in the, at least to the extent that promotions, increase in compensation would be the subject of a collective bargaining agreement or other rules that now exist. And I guess I am a little, I'd like you to clarify why we are taking that out, that last sentence.
I think it's moved by the Legislative Council because one of the, and I'll have Tom speak to this.
It's my understanding there are also some, there are elsewhere in the statute and within the administrative rules, the personnel division provides for who's classified and who's
That's
not.
Right.
I want to make sure we're not making any policy changes here that if this language is necessary and adopted, it's, again, it's not a policy change, but it's just consistent.
What I understand is what the Legislative Council put in to meet the other parts of the law. That's what I understand. Maybe Tom has something.
Tom, can you help me out there a little bit?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, as soon as I get it out. That was at which page of the...
It's page 9 of the engrossed version. It's Section 9, Subsection 6.
Yes. All of that language is deleted regarding employees being in classified service and so forth. There are other sections of the law that designate the classifications of state employees and also designating the handling this by collective bargaining. The language in the old statute was redundant and also was not in compliance with the laws governing state personnel. So we deleted it because it's taken care of elsewhere in the code.
Okay, so again, it does not represent any kind of policy change?
No, none whatsoever.
Okay. Are there any other questions of a technical nature regarding the amendments? Okay, Representative Leek's motion is before us. Is there any further comment or discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Leek.
For the purpose of the bond minority report on this bill, do I have to vote against my own motion here for tonight?
Yes.
I think that would, if you would, that certainly would apply at least to the final motion on the bill, and the chair would be glad to place that motion so you won't be in that position. Okay. We're just dealing with the amendments now, and that motion has been placed. Is there any objection to the amendments to 2908 prepared by the Employment Appeals Board with the assistance of the Employment Division? Any objection? Not, they're adopted. Representative Johnson moves House Bill 2908 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended, and I think we may want to have it engrossed because there have been some substantial changes. Representative DeBoer.
Motion. I'm going to be voting against this bill, and I can't tell you exactly why. It's just that I'm uncomfortable with the whole thing. So, just for the committee's.
Okay. Okay. Is there any further discussion or comment,
Mr. Chair? I think I'm going to join Representative DeBoer for everybody's information. I'm not convinced
cool
that we need the authority. To incur additional monetary costs for pro tem members. I haven't been convinced of that.
Okay. Any other vote explanations or comments at this point? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Ford?
Aye.
Gold?
Aye.
Hanlon?
Nay.
Johnson?
Aye.
Lee?
No.
Shiprack?
Yes.
DeVore?
No.
Springer?
Aye. Motion is adopted.
Lee serves notice of minority report.
Representative Lee serves notice of a possible minority report. Okay. I'll announce a carrier. It may be the chair or somebody else. I'll designate. We're going to take about a 5 or 10 minute recess here and get back on the benefit bills. Please return no later than 10 minutes till 10.
That'll be
it. Labor Committee, come back to order, please. Representative Hanlon, I'm going to recognize you for purposes of telling us where we're at on your benefit bills.
Your sample, you know, and I hope I'm more successful than you've been.
Okay, right. Gentlemen, we're on the record.
Last
Let's
I didn't have any. This time I haven't been any.
Try to pick up where we left off, if not better. We have several sets of amendments, I understand, Representative Hanlon. We also have some individuals who've asked to testify on some of the benefit bills, if you will. We also are going to be relying upon whatever fiscal information is now available, and I think we're kind of at that point. It's now or never, on at least as far as that information, some of which has been provided by the comp department, some of which may be available to us from SAFE. Representative Hanlon, it's up to you.
Mr. Chair, I think if you look at your package, you have a memo from the department dated May 6, 1983.
What bill are we on?
Yeah, what bill? I'm sorry, the fiscal information, first of all, applies
2376, 2378, 2379,
2473. Those are the four bills.
Okay.
If you look at the May 6th interoffice memo, that gives us some fiscal information from the department. And additionally, there is an interoffice memo dated May 12th, 1983. Mm. Fiscal information on the bills that these apply to are 2376, 2378, and 2379. So far as the fiscal information goes, I have been in contact with SAFE, and it's my understanding they're representatives of SAFE, and Insurance Commissioner's Office is represented by Mr. Lamb. I might just ask, prior to going into all three of these bills, if we could have the representatives of the insurance, Mr. Lamb and Representative SAFE, come up and at least explain. It's my understanding Mr. Lamb can explain how these conclusions were reached, that is, where the fiscal impact came from.
That's fine, Mr. Lamb, Mr. McGavick, and whoever wants to come up from SAFE who can explain the assumptions. And Representative Hanlon, I'd ask you to sort of take these, make sure we are referring to the bill, make sure it's clear to members what bill we're referring to.
Mr. Chairman, that's where I'm at.
Okay, that's fine.
Mr. Chair, could I ask,
Representative Johnson,
as Representative Hanlon goes through this, could we be really sure about which documents we're into and the sources and how we got there? Could we have This whole process is a mess from the standpoint of accuracy of information. I'd like to know the source and the dates of all the documents as we go and which bills they apply for the committee's use so that we know we're working with the best information available. Okay.
Mr. Lamb, you have the memo dated May 12th to Lloyd Gardner.
Yes, sir, I do.
At the very beginning of that, there's fiscal impact relating to House Bill 2376, which is the increasing the average weekly wage from 100% all the way up to 200%. What I'd appreciate you doing is telling us how any of those figures were reached. In other words, what data went into producing the percentage increase in overall costs?
Representative Hanlon, maybe for the record, I should say I'm Michael Lamb. I'm casualty actuary for the insurance division. And at your request, I came over this morning to kind of explain maybe the process that the National Council goes through to get these numbers. I have not seen their worksheet, so I can't give you the exact numbers, but I am familiar with the kind of models they use and the procedures, and so I can explain to you their process. I have not gone through these exact computations myself, so I can't verify them exactly, but I can tell you kind of what they do. The council starts with a table that gives a distribution of wages. Distribution meaning you start with the average wage, how many workers are at what ratio to that average wage, how many are twice the wage, how many are 1.5 times the wage, and so forth, and what portion of the total wages are represented by these people, by these workers. Using that table, then, they can evaluate or estimate the effect of changing the maximums or the minimums or changing the percentage of wages that's given for benefits, any of those factors. So in this kind of a case where you're changing the maximum, the procedure they use says, starts out by saying, all right, the benefit is 2/3 of the wage. What portion of the workers, or more exactly, what portion of the total wages is workers who are at the workers who would get either the maximum wage or maximum benefit or the minimum benefit in between there? What portion of the wages does that represent? Well, that times 2/3 is their benefit cost. Those workers and their wages that are above the maximum benefit, they would they're treated as though they've received exactly that maximum benefit wage. And the people who are below the minimum, they're, I think the process assumes $50 for them a week. So using those parts of it, you get an average benefit. And let's maybe say for simplicity, it works out to $200, something like that a week. So then raise the maximum to 200% of the average wage, and that means that workers now who earn up to 3 times the average wage in the state would be at or below the maximum benefit. So now they raise this maximum part of it up that far and include the wages for people up to that point, and just the 2/3 of wages part of the computation, and you get a higher average benefit. And maybe it works out to $220 or so. I suggest 220 because it works out to about 10%, and Don here has some numbers that suggest maybe that's about where it is. So the council would then say that the average temporary disability benefit and also the permanent total benefit to the worker increases 10%, say, for illustration. Then the task then is to decide what portion of the total costs are represented by temporary total and permanent total benefits. The council categorizes claims by the type of injury. So they have claims that are temporary total only, and they have claims that are permanent partial. The permanent partial claims include a temporary disability portion and also a permanent total, a permanent partial award portion. They then have models based on countrywide surveys of these types of injury, which represent what portion of those types of claims what portion of the cost of those types of claims is for temporary total and which part is for permanent partial. And let's assume for illustration that it comes out that maybe a third of the cost of permanent partials is for temporary total portion. And add that to the total is for temporary total only. And they come up with a number that's probably somewhere between 25 and 30% of total claim cost is for temporary total. And the similar figure for permanent total, I'm assuming permanent total is included in this proposal. I haven't looked at it lately. But, the number there for the benefit to the worker would come out to somewhere around 5% of the total cost. So we're looking at about a third of the total cost is benefits related directly to the wage in the way that temporary total and permanent total benefits are. So if you took a third times the 10%, you'd get around 3%. Obviously, my numbers are a little bit higher than what they came out. They came out with 1.7.
The 1.7 then, just as an example, the 1.7% increase is increase in overall comps and work overall costs in workers' compensation. And basically the steps you took us through is what the NCCI did in coming up with these fiscal impacts.
Well, that's the model they've used in the past and okay. Evaluating all these things, and I'm assuming that they've done the same thing. They usually follow the kind of actuarial methods that have been used and are accepted by the actuarial profession.
For the committee's information, I received this memo this morning along with the rest of us, this one dated May 12th. I also asked that SAFE take a look at what was supplied us by the Workers' Comp Department and see if they could come up with their own figures or at least comment on whether there was any material differences with what SAFE could come up with as opposed to these two memos we have dated May 6th and May 12th. Mr. Sutherland, can you comment on that?
Well, I took a more pragmatic method. We have the average, we have the weekly wage of the claimant that file. And I took two fiscal years and analyzed them, 78, 79, and 79, 80. And I did that because I didn't know how to access the file for more recent periods to begin with.
We need to have your name on the record.
Sutherland, Don Sutherland from SAFE.
Thank you.
And secondly, the older the fiscal year is, the more representative the data becomes because you get the duration of the time loss paid and the amount, of course, increases over time.